DiscerningHearts.com presents Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I'm delighted to be joined by Trent Horn, who is an apologist and speaker for Catholic Answers. He specializes in pro-life issues as well as outreach to atheists and agnostics. He holds a master's degree in theology from Franciscan University of Steubenville. With Trent Horn, we go inside the pages of Answering Atheism, How to Make the Case for God with Logic and Charity, published by Catholic Answers Press. Trent, thank you so much for joining me.
No problem.
Answering Atheism, How to Make the Case for God with Logic and Charity. That's the key, isn't it, with charity?
Yes. St. Paul says in Ephesians 4:15, we should speak the truth in love. So we shouldn't compromise on either. We should speak what's true and use logic and reasoning, but we should do so in a loving way so that our message will be better understood and received by those we're speaking to.
It's a phenomenal book because I don't think there's an area in which you fail to cover. It gives all the different perspectives. And the thing that I found, Trent, in reading it is that for many people, they probably don't even appreciate that they may have aspects of atheism as part of their philosophy. A lot of it is just in society, don't you think, that atheism has permeated so deeply that we're not even aware that this may be what we're encountering?
Yes, even among believers, even among faithful Catholics. For example, I think one attitude that's very prevalent nowadays that's really been brought up due to the resurgence in atheism is the idea that you can only really believe something or really accept something as true if it's verified by science. So unless a scientist in a white lab coat with a beaker and a machine tells you that it's true or exists, you can't have a reliable certainty. And what I try to show in my book is that you can have certainty about the existence of many things science can't prove, one of which is the existence of an infinite and personal God.
It is probably easier, isn't it, for us to prepare ourselves to talk with someone who is an atheist than it is potentially to talk to someone who is agnostic?
I guess it depends. In my book, I distinguish between an atheist and an agnostic. Now, many atheists themselves really are agnostics. They just don't want to accept the label. The big difference that I think is the correct difference is that when it comes to the question, does God exist, an atheist says, no, God does not exist. And an agnostic says, well, I don't know. Could be yes, could be no. And so I think you're correct. It can be easier sometimes to speak with an atheist or someone who says God does not exist because he has a burden of proof on his position. If he says there is no God, he needs to offer some kind of argument or reason to think God doesn't exist. And then, you know, you or I could engage them in charitable dialogue and say, well, how do your arguments stand up? This doesn't quite make sense to me. But an agnostic could just say, I don't know, and just be skeptical and not accept any arguments you give him, which would be unfortunate because I think there's many good arguments that show that God really does exist.
Trent, isn't it unfortunate, again, too, that in a lot of encounters that we may have with others, and this subject or the subject of God or religion or something comes up, we are more prone now to, well, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to engage in a religious dialogue because there is a basic intimidation, isn't there?
Yes, I think that's unfortunate in the modern culture we live in, especially one saturated with political correctness, multiculturalism, and relativism, which basically says, well, everyone's viewpoints are equally valid and you have to respect what everyone believes, and it's wrong to quote-unquote, push your beliefs onto other people. And I don't think we should be pushy with our beliefs, but I do believe that there are truths about the world, and we're all better people if we strive for the truth. And we as Catholics believe we do have the truth. It's not something to brag or boast about, but something that we should honestly and patiently share with other people. And so I think what can be helpful to take the edge out of these conversations when it's intimidating It's just to ask good questions. Ask an atheist or an agnostic friend why they believe what they do and why they're not convinced by the Catholic position, and then just try to have good dialogue based on those questions.
What would you say would be the number one thing someone encounters when they begin to have that dialogue with someone who wears that atheism mantle?
I think the number one thing that comes up is just a general belief that there's no evidence for God and that it's just simply a matter of faith, that people believe God exists because they have this feeling that God is there, or they just have, quote-unquote, faith God exists. But faith is something you have in the absence of evidence or even in spite of evidence, and that, once again, science can't show God and there's no good reason to think there's a God, therefore it's all just a matter of faith. And so I think what we have to do is we have to redefine some of these terms to get our conversation off on the right foot. First, science, while it's great at discovering things about the natural world, science has limits. It can only tell us things about how the way the world is, the natural world. It's agnostic about whether there's a supernatural world. And there's many things we believe in that can't be scientifically proven, like moral facts or morality itself can't be derived from science, because science is about what is, not what ought to be. So that's science, and faith isn't just believing willy-nilly. Faith is about having trust. The Catechism says faith is just a trust in God's promises. So if we see there are good reasons to believe God exists, then we have trust or a confidence in those reasons, and ultimately a confidence or trust in the God that those evidences and reasons point towards. So just to show people, look, there are reasons in our natural world that if we use philosophy, point beyond it to a God that exists, and there's good reasons to believe in that God.
These discussions that we have are so, or should I even make it more than just, make it more personal, those conversations that we have with others about this, when we begin to really probe it, have it literally life-altering consequences.
Yes, absolutely. What you believe about God and the universe and human beings greatly affects your worldview. I mean, if you believe that everything that exists is an accident and that there are no immaterial things, we're all just collections of atoms, you might come to very different views, and some people come to a nihilistic view. They think that, well, nothing really matters at all. I think the premier atheistic nihilist would be Friedrich Nietzsche, the 19th century philosopher. But yeah, we have to talk to people. This isn't some kind of intellectual parlor game when we're trading these arguments and reasons. We're trying to give people a path to believe in the loving God of the universe, the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Jesus Christ. And so we want people to come to know this God, know God and the Holy Trinity as a person. But sometimes you got to give those reasons. And morality is a good one, that many people see that, well, some things really are right and really are wrong. I mean, it's a fact that it's just wrong to torture babies for fun. That's a true statement, but you can't scientifically prove that it's true. And it would be true even if a majority of people thought torturing infants was fun. And in my book, Answering Atheism, I show how these objective moral truths, they point to an objective moral lawgiver that transcends time and space, and that could only be a perfectly good God.
Well, that's the problem in so many ways, is because the argument becomes, well, then your definition of good may be different than what my definition of good is.
Sure, absolutely. And so what we have to do there is put on our philosopher hats and talk to the other person, and I would ask them to define, well, what does it mean for something to be good? And in particular, what does it mean for it to be evil? I find that within a theistic framework, theism, coming from the Greek word for God, theos, from the theistic point of view, good and evil make a lot of sense, because good just refers to the way a thing is supposed to be. And evil happens when things are not the way they are supposed to be, or that we're deviating from a great cosmic plan. Now, if you're an atheist, defining good and evil, I mean, it's easy to define pleasure and pain. Pleasure makes me feel good, or I enjoy it, and pain is something I want to get away from. But sometimes there are evil pleasures and good pains. Like if you go on that, you run a marathon, or even when you go to the dentist, it might hurt, but it actually is good for you. So we have to get away from a primitive hedonistic outlook on the world. And I think that the Catholic worldview shows that the deep things we believe in, like good and evil and justice and dignity, make the most sense in a creation that God has made for humans like us.
Your book, Answering Atheism, Trent, is so rich in the information, the guidance that you give those who are trying to seek answers, not only for themselves, but to be able to assist those that they love and those they encounter, to come to see and have that relationship that's so important with God that we have found with Him. But it also, it challenges us to that very nature of what is authentic charity. Because by saying nothing, if we really truly believe this is truth, and they are indeed going down a different path, I mean, that is something that it's incumbent upon the Christian to suffer even in entering into that truth discussion.
Oh, sure. I remember, and I speak about this a little bit in my book about how we need to share our faith with others. I talk in one of the chapters about a magician named Penn Jillette. He currently performs in Vegas under the act Penn and Teller.
Mm-hmm.
And Penn, he released a video a few years ago. He's an atheist, a very committed atheist, but he enjoys proselytizing. He thought it was great after one show when a Christian man gave him a Bible and sincerely said that he wanted Penn to be saved. And Penn said, you know, I'm an atheist, but if you truly believe that if you don't tell me about Jesus, I'll go to hell, then how much would you have to hate me to not tell me that? So, I mean, we do have a duty to share the faith with others, and the most basic aspect of our faith is that God exists. Another reason I wrote the book Answering Atheism was to help people overcome the intellectual difficulties in sharing about this topic. In the book, I try to break down science and philosophy so that people can understand it and understand how to reply to the objections to the arguments many atheists make, and just so that the conversation can move forward.
I think one of the toughest conversations that can be undertaken are those, again, with agnostics, when they look at us and say, well, I believe in God. I believe that there is a great force that has set all this in motion, or whatever it is, that how they might express it. But it's the people in religion, it's religion over the years that has, I want nothing to do with that. How can that possibly be an expression of God? Because look how badly people have acted.
Sure. And I speak about this in the book, about bad attitudes sometimes people bring to the table. One of them is that you cannot say that a belief system is true or false simply based on the conduct of some people in that system. Because if you said, well, I'm not going to follow a belief system that has had evil people in it, well, then every single belief system in the world would be disqualified. You couldn't be an atheist, because there have been atheist dictators that have killed millions of people and have justified their crimes, because we live in a godless world. You can think of people like Stalin or Pol Pot.
Mm-hmm.
So just because there have been hypocrites in a belief system doesn't show the belief system itself is false. So for an agnostic, well, the more proper term would be a deist, a person who believes in a God who's out there, but not in a revealed religion. We can show that their desire for authenticity, their desire to be authentic and to be good and hold up to a moral standard, makes the most sense actually within Christianity. And that if you read Matthew 23, Jesus was very stern towards religious leaders of his own day who were inauthentic and who were hypocrites. So those kind of people may, for lack of a better term, have a friend in Jesus in that regard.
It is interesting, isn't it, Trent, that I think of the numerous discussions now that are occurring within the areas of physics, and how the arguments that are going back and forth, even to what they thought was a for sure, you know, like with gravity, it has led, or the Big Bang has led to, when you take the thought, when you logically go through things into deeper and more penetrating and numerous other options, that there isn't a for sure out there, except ultimately leads you back to that greater creator.
Yes, I'd say so. In fact, in my book, I present two arguments that use data from physics that serve as signposts to that creator. One of them would be that even if we look at the Big Bang, if we go beyond the Big Bang, when we look at a special field of physics that deals with gravity called general relativity, when that's applied to the universe as a whole, we see that even if there was something before the Big Bang, it's more than likely that there was an ultimate beginning to the physical universe. And if there is an ultimate beginning, then there would have to be a transcendent cause to bring it into existence. The other facet I talk about in the book is that when you look at the laws of physics, think of things like E equals mc squared or the gravitational constants, these letters in the scientific equations that never change have precise values that are set for apparently no reason at all. And the odds of them all being set so that we have a life-permitting universe are so low that you would have a better chance of finding a randomly marked atom somewhere in the known universe. You'd have a better chance of doing that than having all the laws set up just right to have a life-permitting universe like ours. And I think that speaks well of a cosmic designer who has fine-tuned the universe so that intelligent life like us can exist.
I think that the most important conversations can happen with the person that you may be able to help them to see that indeed they are not truly atheistic, but maybe more of that deistic type of, that he is a God out there that, well, okay, he may have created all this, but why in the world would he possibly care about me? He doesn't care about us individually. He just might have set all these things into motion. Mm. And that's where charity comes in, because relationship is everything, isn't it?
Oh, sure. And I think that, as Paul tells us in his letters, that we can comfort others because of the comfort that we first received in Christ. And so I think that there's a point where we can give, evidence for a God who's out there or for deism. But then there's that next step. Well, what about the God who knows me, created me, and loves me? And that is probably one of the greatest mysteries in the universe, that God does love us. He genuinely does. And so we can share that love with others and then provide good evidence that God has revealed himself to human beings. He hasn't left us as orphans or in the dark, but he's revealed to us through Scripture, through Revelation, and ultimately through his Son, Jesus Christ. And that's actually going to be a future book project of mine. This book, Answering Atheism, I wanted to put all my efforts towards just proving one proposition that God does exist. And then in a future book, using more historical evidence to show we have good reasons to think God has intervened in human affairs in the person of Jesus of Nazareth.
Trent, in all your discussions and all of the conversations that you've had with other people around this topic, and particularly those that you've engaged in with atheists, what has been some of the most, I want to say surprising, but what it, the most just kind of just took you aback in either the response or maybe even the argument?
Well, I think one of the most surprising things I've seen is the lengths that people will go, the things they will believe, just so they don't have to accept the conclusion that God exists. Mm. They'll seemingly deny what seems to be simple, common sense evidence. When I show convincing evidence that the universe began to exist from nothing, they may simply deny the truth that something cannot come from nothing. They may say, well, maybe something can come from nothing, so I don't need to believe in a creator. Or I've met many atheists, when I show them how morality, objective moral truths, points to God, they simply deny that morality is objective. When I ask them, is it a fact that, raping or torturing children is always wrong, they say, well, I can't say that. As an atheist, I can't say it's wrong. It's just something I disagree with, or it's just a different way of behaving than me. And so I find that just astounding. And I think most people who aren't caught up in philosophical deliberations and kind of stay firm to their intuitions about reality see, well, no, things that exist have a cause. Things that begin to exist have a cause, and some things really are wrong, and you're not going to convince me otherwise. And for those people, I think those intuitions naturally lead back to God and can help to foster faith.
I'm reminded of the life of St. Augustine, who he was, I think we can say, one of the most brilliant men in the Western civilization, and is realized just through his writings and everything. And it wasn't even so much arguments, because he could, the rhetoric and everything else, he could go through all that. It wasn't until he had a transformation of heart. There's something that happens. And I think I keep going back to that. It's logic and charity, because that really is the key. That's what will unlock the door, isn't it?
Oh, yes. I love what St. Augustine says, is that our hearts are restless, Lord, until they rest in you. We sort of have a God-shaped hole in our hearts that when we try to fill with material things, we understand that those material things rot, they decay, and that ultimately, even if we have all that we want, we will perish one day and will be forgotten by nearly everyone. So what's the point of it all? And so I think that living a life that's authentic, that not only just knowing God exists is a proposition, but knowing God himself, the person of God, and living as if God, knowing that God is a real person in life and that he has a eternal plan for us, living that way can impress many people. And so if we can show that to others without being pushy or defensive, they can genuinely want to know about it. And in that context, we have a good place to give good reasons to think that what we believe isn't just pleasing or good, but it's true.
We're talking with Trent Horn about his phenomenal book, Answering Atheism, How to Make the Case for God with Logic and Charity. And you have beautifully articulated in the appendix of the book St. Thomas's arguments, which, boy, ever ancient, ever new. I mean, they still hold up, don't they?
They really do. In the main part of the book, I presented four arguments for God that I find are easy to use in conversations with non-believers. But I felt that Thomas's five ways, particularly his first and second way, are still very good arguments. And so I present a brief defense of them. However, I do feel that while they're very strong, the arguments are easily misunderstood if you don't understand Thomas's metaphysics, mm-hmm. which is how he views reality as a whole. If you don't understand that, you won't understand the terms he uses, and you'll think he's making a very weak or basic argument. That's the mistake Richard Dawkins made with Aquinas' argument in his bestseller, The God Delusion. So I try to fix those mistakes, answer those objections, but ultimately I point the readers towards what I think is the best full-length treatment of Thomas's arguments, which is Aquinas, A Beginner's Guide by Edward Fezzer. And he also has a new book out called Scholastic Metaphysics. But it can be difficult to sift through the medieval terminology, but when you have it, it's a great argument to present to non-believers to show that even though it's ever ancient, it's still ever new. It has great impact for faith.
Trent, I think we live in a culture that, give you the 1200s, had its challenges and it had its moral struggles, but mm-hmm. can we say nothing quite like the present day? Abortion and all those other horrific things that we just accept as common day now.
I feel that, yes, if you transported the saints to the modern day, people like Augustine, Aquinas, Francis de Sales, St. Teresa of Lisieux, if you transported them to the modern day, I think they would just be shocked at the challenges that Christians have to face. Now, some of them are challenges that you've always had to face, this, scorn of unbelievers or sexual immorality. I mean, Augustine struggled with that extensively. But just the ease with which you can choose to not believe in God, the ease with which you can take part in sinful activities to pull away from God, the glorification of sin and evil in our culture, and just the society where when these saints lived, at least those who lived after the fall of the Roman Empire, before the Enlightenment, they lived in a Christian society. The truth of the gospel was just taken for granted, and they would be amazed to see Christians trying to reach out to share their faith in what has now become a post-Christian culture where faithful believers who are really committed to the gospel are actually really in the minority and have to struggle to present this truth to an unbelieving world.
You remind me of St. Ignatius of Loyola as we look at the discernment of spirits, and he would talk as you grow in your faith, as you grow in your prayer life, that there will be distractions. The enemy will use all kinds of noise to try to take you off target and to lead you down a path. I can't even imagine what St. Ignatius would say about the distractions that we have today. I mean, just the constant noise and the constant blur. And that's why for us as Christians, and in particular how you've articulated everything so clearly, that we cannot be afraid to witness and to have a reason and to know that those arguments for our faith to help others.
Absolutely.
Have you had the opportunity to be able to experience in those who you've had these conversations with, and maybe they have in that classic meaning of the word convert, their conversion, that ongoing turning towards Christ. Have you had the chance to see how life transforming it can be?
I have. I will say that the process is a lengthy one. Anyone who changes a major worldview, it takes time. Several years ago, I helped mentor a friend who was an agnostic who had left the Catholic Church. We had met doing pro-life work and was just able to answer his questions. And then after a course of about 8 or 9 months, he went from being an agnostic to going back to church and even became confirmed. And it was those scientific reasons and those philosophical reasons that helped him see faith was reasonable. And even on the radio show, when people call in, I only have maybe 8 minutes, 7 to 8 minutes to speak with them. I might present an argument and just hear at the end of the call, well, I've never really thought about it that way before. Or thank you for presenting something that's so reasonable. They may not change their mind right on the spot, but I can see that the ticker has moved a little bit in the direction towards belief and towards faith. And I think that's always grateful, and I hope the path continues for that person.
This may seem like an odd question, Trent, but what would you say to that person out there who has firmly grounded themselves in many of the things that you have taught in the book and Catholic Answers has provided, so they feel they can enter into that discussion? And in some cases, it turns into a debate, you know, it's either kids or family members. But what would you say to them when it's time to back off a bit, so sometimes we get so excited about the argument and winning it that we want to win the debate, but we end up losing the war. We end up losing the contact with that person. I mean, what's the fine line there?
Well, I think it was the Venerable Fulton Sheen who said one could win an argument but lose a soul or lose a person. Mm-hmm. And so in that case, it just requires on basic social skills, really. And that's where I recommend asking more questions than giving statements. Mm-hmm. And asking the person, can I share with you a few reasons that I find are convincing? Ask the person what they think of it. And then using your own best judgment to see if they're really interested in continuing the conversation or if they need to let it go. And then letting it go so that they can think it through. If they feel that you've just boxed them into a corner and you're berating them with arguments, they're not going to be open to changing their mind. But if you take a humble approach and say, well, this argument or this reason is compelling to me, what do you think of it? And just let it marinate a bit, it can have a lot more of an effect. So just I would encourage these listeners, use your best judgment and don't worry about winning the argument. Worry about winning the person. And if you don't know an answer to their question, say, you know, I don't know the answer to that, but I'm willing to look it up and get back to you. And that demonstration of humility will go a long way.
Answering Atheism, How to Make the Case for God with Logic and Charity is absolutely phenomenal. I wish we had more time. Of course, then we can hear you on Catholic Answers live, as well as be able to dive into the book. But it's in our brief time together right now, any final thoughts?
I would just say that don't write off unbelieving friends and family members and say, oh, well, I can't help them. God has placed you in their life for a certain reason, and he's given you a mind to know and love him. So I would encourage you to, and all our listeners, to read and study and learn more about God and the reasons to think God is real, and then share those both in arguments, both in verbal reasons, and also in an authentic life that is lived for God, which can be sometimes even more persuasive.
Well said. Trent, thank you so much.
No problem.
With Trent Horn, we've gone inside the pages of Answering Atheism, How to Make the Case for God with Logic and Charity. To learn more about this book or to obtain a copy, go to Catholic.com, the website for its publisher, Catholic Answers, or you can find it at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and or to download this discussion along with many others, go to DiscerningHearts.com. This has been a production of DiscerningHearts.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, Insights from Today's Most Compelling Authors.